tell up here, so I'm just going to go with yes. How's everybody doing? Good? Pretty good? All right. Well, I'm going to keep talking from Chronicles here, chapters 18 and 19. Everybody ready for Christmas? One of us is ready. So what happened in chapter 17? Like, what's the story as we pick it up? Sorry? Not a test. You can, I never, by the way, I never answer these questions. Like, when Rob on Sunday is like asking these questions and there's like Blake's like really loud, like he's like, I know it. I'm always like, whether I know it or don't know it, I'm always like, I'm not saying anything. The introvert in me, I guess. But so no judgment, obviously. But if, I mean, what was like the, what are we talking about? Cause it is important to contextualize this. So David's prayer of Thanksgiving. Was it you? Do you count? Yeah. Who is going to build the temple? Right. Right. Not David. Right. Yeah. David's son, Solomon is who, it is revealed will be, building the, temple. And so, David has a different role. Actually, I'm going to, talk funny tonight a little bit. These two chapters we're going to read have a lot of, like different names and all these kind of things that are, they made me do the research anyway. And I was doing it, I was thinking about it. And, so I had to study some names anyway. And so, you know, as I thought about it, I thought it might be interesting in this section. I think it would be a little bit overbearing to do this all the time. You know, you would end up just kind of glazing over probably. But I'm going to try to kind of pronounce everybody's name kind of in the same way that, you know, any speaker up here might try to pronounce like a foreign name that comes up in the text. So like instead of saying David, I'll say like David or whatever to keep some like continuity because but also there's something, and like I say, this isn't a criticism of doing it this way in general, but I think it is, maybe important to step back and realize like when we say all the names we know, the Davids, the Solomons, the Jerusalems, the Israels, when we say them with our Americanized, you know, English way of saying them and juxtapose them next to all these other foreign names from around Israel, it kind of feels like a different section of the world or something. And it's, especially in these verses, I think important to realize we're so close geographically, culturally, we're, you know, Israel and all of the people of Israel that we know and kind of throw off, you know, like nothing in our, you know, Davids or Solomons. That these are actually people that have funny sounding names too to us. They're actually from the same part of the world. They don't, you don't get on a plane, you know, they didn't get on a plane from Atlanta, fly over there and start some wars. They were already there and these wars were going on. So it's kind of an experiment. And if it bothers you, sorry, but that's what we're doing. So David, was told, that his son was going to build a temple for the Lord. And, here in these chapters, we're going to see him make some preparations for that. He's going to, build some military security, for his son, that he can then go on to, have the peace necessary, to build a temple. He's also going to, in the process of these military security efforts, he's going to actually amass a great wealth. And so, you know, this great wealth is going to be something that can be stored in the temple and can be a symbol, a picture, an offering of sorts to God and say, you know, we think this much of you and we throw a bunch of gold and silver in there. So he's going to do, these two kind of things because he doesn't want to be a passive player. He's not told, well, your son's going to do it, so you don't have anything to do. He's told your son is going to do it. And so David's like, well, I'm still going to play as active a role of this as I can. And that's really, really kind of a cool thing. So let's, find the thing. Here it is. And then let's read some stuff. Here we go from chapter 18. After this, David defeated the Pelishtines and subdued them, and he took Gat and his villages out of the hand of the Pelishtines, and he defeated Moab, and the Moabites became servants to David and brought tribute. Real quick, just halfway through here, I just kind of wish we were given a little bit more, in this because, David has a little bit of a, history with the Moabites. His grandmother, anybody know who his grandmother is? It is Ruth, or Ruth, and she was a Moabite, and he had also entrusted his parents with her care, with not her care, but with the care of the Moabites. So I don't know what happened to kind of fracture that relationship. We'll never know, I guess, but it's interesting. Keep reading. David also defeated Hadarezer, king of Hovah, Hamath, as he went up to set up his monument on the river Perat. I don't know how they got Euphrates from Perat. And David took him from, took from him 1,000 chariots, 7,000 horsemen, and 20,000 foot soldiers. And David hamstrung all the chariot horses, but left enough for 100 chariots. And when the Aramens of Damascus, or Syrians of Damascus, came to help Hadarezer, king of Zobah, David struck down 22,000 men of the Aramens. Then David put garrisons in Aram of Damascus, and the Aramans became servants to David and brought tribute, and the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. And David took the shields of gold that were carried by the servants of Hadarezer and brought them to Jerusalem. Jerusalem's the hardest one to say. All these other non-Israeli places are much more easy, much less difficult. And from Tibhat and from Kun, cities of Hadarezer, David took a large amount of bronze. With it, Shlomo made the bronze sea and the pillars and the vessels of bronze. When Tou, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated the whole army of Hadarezer, king of Zobah, he sent his son Hadoram to King David to ask about his health and to bless him because he had fought against Hadarezer and defeated him, for Hadarezer had often been at war with Tou. And he sent all sorts of articles of gold, of silver, and of bronze. These also King David dedicated to the Lord, together with the silver and gold that he had carried off from all the nations, from Edom, Moab, the Ammonites, the Philistines, and Amalek. And Avishai, the son of Seruiah, killed 18,000 Edomites in the valley of Melak, or Salt, again, I don't know. Then he put garrisons in Edom, and all the Edomites became David's servants. And the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. So David reigned over all Israel, and he administered justice and equity to all his people. And Yoav, son of Seruiah, was over the army, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. And Sadok, the son of Ahituv, and Avimelech, the son of Abiathar, were priests, and Shavsta was secretary, and Benaiah, the son of Yehoyada, was over the Keretites and the Pelatites, and David's sons were the chief officials in the service of the king. That's all of chapter 18. So, don't clap yet. I got a whole other chapter to mess it up. But I actually really like at the end of this chapter, we get to see kind of the end credits that, you know, this is where all the tough pronunciations are not fun, but it's actually cool, to see all these names because, you know, we realize that these are the people, that helped make Israel the great nation that it is. You know, it's not just David. It's actually all these people that are helping him out. And, Shaul, better known as Saul, that was David's father, right? Shaul, never had a list like that, did he? Like, we never read about him actually thanking the people that were integral parts of his kingdom. But David is able to democratize the leadership, at least to the degree that others are helping and being recognized for it. And I think that's really cool. Even though I don't know anything about them and don't really care about them, except that I had to learn their names. But they're listed, and that's actually enough to indicate something there. So, as we'd expect, that is the type of humble leadership that David is expressing here, that leads to better things for the people of Israel. Any country, any organization, any group of any kind is going to be healthier with a team of people leading it rather than an individual. It's just the way it is. And this chapter So it's almost verbatim the same as the parallel in 2 Samuel 8, or what is it, 2 Shemuel 8. And it's basically just David beating up everyone in the neighborhood. But there's one tiny difference, very small difference in these accounts, that I do want to talk about for a second, because it carries the potential to be actually a larger and more difficult difference for someone. And it's the kind of thing that happens quite often in the biblical records. Verse 4 from this chapter, it mentions that David took 7,000 horsemen. But in 2 Shemuel 8, it says, depending on what version, either 700, 1700, or the identical 7,000. And it seems, from my research, that 700 is actually more what the original manuscripts had said. And so, you know, some have presumed that the number, the reason for the difference is because the chariots were divided into companies of 10. And, I mean, that may be true. I don't know. I don't really think they know. I think it's just sort of a presumption they're making to make it work. And that's cool. I mean, I'm totally cool with the chariots being divided by 10. But it doesn't say that. And so it still kind of makes this feel like a contradiction. And by the most strict definition of the word, the kind of definition a child might hold to when he or she is pointing out your mistakes, the Bible's lying, right? I mean, by the strictest definitions of it, the Bible is lying, because surely one of these figures is correct, and scholars, for whatever reason, seem to think it's this account and not the other. But then that would mean that the other one isn't. I mean, it can't be 700 and 7,000. It can't be both. It can't be 700, 1,700 and 7,000 for sure. And so if it's not correct, then we have to say, well, does the doctrine of inerrancy fall apart? And if inerrancy falls apart, does infallibility fall apart? And if inerrancy and infallibility fall apart, can we trust anything in the Bible? And if the Bible falls apart, can God be real? Maybe the skeptics are right. Maybe this is all a big fantasy that we've been living in. And I mean, these are the kind of thoughts that, not necessarily on this, but on different things, will fall through my heads when I read the stuff. Maybe I'm alone. But I think that we all find kind of these easy places of doubt sometimes. And so I just want to point out that maybe, I mean, perhaps this is all fake. I mean, I would have to be naive and probably disingenuous not to admit that that's possible. Sure. Otherwise, faith isn't even faith. It's just fact. But if it's wrong, if we're all wrong and we're all wasting our time here, it's not because of a silly oversight made by a copyist thousands of years ago. We can't let these kind of, you know, minutiae trip up our faith, because God's truth isn't carried by a missing digit in the detail of the numbers of chariots David captured from Hadar Ezer. You know, and it's actually difficult for me to imagine God caring about this at all. This is me going off for a little bit. But that might actually explain most clearly why the oversight occurs in the first place. I mean, if God actually cared about this, it wouldn't be wrong, right? I mean, he's God. He can kind of figure out how to make this thing work. You know, he knows how to add a zero in there, you know. He's got the power. And so if God doesn't care, if what instead he seems to care about is delivering the infallible message of his power through the lowly, sometimes careless use of human scribes. And I mean, that's what I am right now standing. I am a, you know, lowly, sometimes careless scribe. We don't write it down the same way. It's done differently, but it's the same role. And I'm going to mess up. Rob's going to mess up. Everybody you're going to hear and read is going to mess up. And so do these people. And so what? I mean, that's sort of me. And I'm not saying that it is or isn't anything. I'm just saying that it's not something that should be tripping us up in a major way. If we have bigger questions, go research, but don't let it really impact you negatively. So, and I'm sure we also all see, you know, different messages in that about maybe losing ourselves in the details of our work on this earth. If we're so focused on what really matters, you know, namely loving God, loving others, you know, and if we slip up on some of the minor details of that, I'm not sure that that's the worst problem in God's eyes. You know, and so maybe don't beat ourselves up whenever we maybe miss a digit in something more, you know, real in our own lives and more present in our own lives than just a document we're reading. You know, that kind of stuff God has grace for. He wants us to be seeking him. And if we're doing that, you know, the things will fall in line and they'll take care of themselves. And God has our back when it doesn't. So when these contradictions or numerical discrepancies come up, we don't need to sweat it. If I stumble upon a verse in Colossians that directly argues against the deity of Christ, or a verse in Philippians that directly argues against the resurrection, those aren't there, by the way, I've read those books, they're not there, then I'll really have to wrestle with some kind of understanding of a God with multiple personality disorder. But if, like here, he remains of one mind, of one personality, and with a cohesive message, then, you know, we're fine. We're cooler than, who's cool? We're cooler than Kendrick at the Grammys. Everybody in here gets that reference. We're hip. Let's keep reading in chapter 19. Kendrick, that's my man right there. So let's get into chapter 19 here. Now after this, Nahush, the king of the Ammonites, died and his son reigned in his place. And David said, I will deal kindly with Hanun, the son of Nahush, for his father dealt kindly with me. So David sent messengers to console him concerning his father, and David's servants came to the land of the Ammonites to Hanun to console him. But the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun, do you think because David has sent comforters to you that he is honoring your father? Have not his servants come to you to search and to overthrow and to spy out the land? So Hanun took David's servants and shaved them and cut off their garments in the middle at their hips and sent them away, and they departed. When David was told concerning the men, he sent messengers to meet them, for the men were greatly ashamed, and the king said, remain at Yeriho until your beards have grown and then return. When the Ammonites saw that they had become a stench to David, Hanun and the Ammonites sent 1,000 talents of silver to hire chariots and horsemen from Aram Naharaim, or Mesopotamia. Again, I don't know where some of these names come from. From Aram Maaka and from Zovah. They hired 32,000 chariots, and the king of Maaka with his army who came and encamped before Medeba. And the Ammonites were mustered from their cities. They came to battle. When David heard of it, he sent Yoav and all the army of the mighty men. And the Ammonites came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the city. And the kings who had come were by themselves in the open country. Excuse me. Been a little bit sore throat, so bear with me with that. But in some of these chapters, David can kind of, for me, and hopefully you don't have this problem, but for me, in some of these chapters, he can kind of come across cruel or power hungry sometimes. But then we get to these moments like this one, you know, where at the top of the chapter here, where David feels compelled to show kindness to the king of Ammon after his father's death. He sympathizes, and then he acts on that sympathy by sending messengers of comfort. And then his kindness is met with wickedness as the new king listens to the poor advice from his council and disgraces David's ambassadors by shaving their beards, which is very shameful in that part of the world. Even still today, you're not going to find a Middle Eastern man without a beard that's really holding his head up high. But then also cutting their clothes down the middle, effectively sending them home naked. You know, good to be that guy, right? I mean, he's got nothing going for him. It's ridicule big time. And of course, to disrespect the king's ambassadors is to disrespect the king himself. And of course, you know, none of these people have anything against these people are just messengers. They probably don't really care about them, but they want to send, send a message back to David, and what better way to do it than this? It's very much like Jesus talking to his disciples in John 15 when he says that if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. You know, if you're hating the disciples, the messengers, the servants, it's really David that is being hated here. But my favorite thing about this whole episode, and really these two chapters we're looking at here, is actually there in verse 5 when David tells his men to wait at Yeriho until their beards have grown and then to simply return home at that point. So how easy would it have been for David to use these men for political leverage? He could have gotten all the local 24-hour news stations upset at Amon, right? I mean, look at what they did to us, right? I mean, look at these people. These are innocent messengers, and would have been plastered all over, you know, CNN, everyone, right? And, but instead, he shows care for the men's dignity and honor, choosing patience to allow them time to return with a degree of dignity. And Amon, in this episode, though, he assumes that this is going to trigger war, so he hires Boba Fett and a bunch of horsemen as a mercenary army. And when David hears of this, he then sends his mighty men to chase after him. Mighty men, does that not sound like, it just sounds like a kid's movie, right? I just can't, like, everything, when I read it, it doesn't sound that absurd. When I say it out loud, it's like Robin Hood, right? I don't understand. I don't know. We gotta work on a translation for that. I'm sure he had something. I'm sure it was less insulting at the time, right? Hey, you mighty men want to go to battle? I don't think he was doing that. But silliness like that aside, doesn't this kind of feel real? Like, no matter how many, and even urgent, like, no matter how many advances we make in communication technology, this still feels so, like, plausible. Sending messengers over there and they're disgraced. I'm going to wait, but he's already, assuming that we were going to attack. So he's going to line up an army now we have to line up an army. And I mean, it just feels like this is the kind of thing that happens in world politics all the time. Internet doesn't help us, phones don't help us. We just, we're humans and we have a tendency to just do things wrong and to assume other people are going to do things wrong and be right in that assumption, but wrong in which wrong they're going to be. It's just, there's just no way around that. And throughout human history and kind of, forecasting our own future, we're going to do that. We're going to miscommunicate and we're going to have wars that probably don't need to happen. And we're going to have times where we do good things and show grace and show mercy, and give these people a chance, to come back with dignity. And then, our enemy is in the meantime building armies. It's just going to happen that way. And it's a bummer, but God could still show up in that stuff. Let's read, the rest of this chapter starting in verse 10. When Yoav saw that the battle was set against him, both in front and in the rear, he chose some of the best men of Israel and arrayed them against the Aramens. The rest of his men he put in charge of Avishai, his brother, and they were arrayed against the Ammonites. And he said, if the Aramens are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I will help you. Be strong and let us use our strength for our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what seems good to him. So Yoav and the people who were with him drew near before the Aramens for battle, and they fled before him. And when the Ammonites saw that the Aramens fled, they likewise fled before Avishai, Yoav's brother, and entered the city. Then Yoav came to Yerushalayim. I told you it's the hardest one. But when the Aramens saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they sent messengers and brought out the Aramens who were beyond the Perat with Shofak. Don't mispronounce that one. The commander of the army of Hadarazer at their head. All right. And it was told to David. When it was told to David, he gathered all Israel together and crossed the Yarden and came to them and drew up his forces against them. And when David set the battle in array against the Aramens, they fought with him, and the Aramens fled before Israel, and David killed of the Aramens the men of 7,000 chariots and 40,000 soldiers, and put to death also Shofak, don't mispronounce his name, the commander of their army. And when the servants of Hadarazer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with David and became subject to him, so the Aramens were not willing to save the Ammonites anymore. So, isn't it interesting that Yoav, despite being surrounded by, Ammon, never even considers surrender or the possibility of defeat? Like, that doesn't seem to be anything that's even entering his stream of conscience. Like, we're going to win. Let's figure out how this is going to go. And so he considers that one flank might be, because he's surrounded. I mean, He's surrounded. You don't win, or at least you don't assume you're going to win. And so he considers the fact that one flank might get taken. But if that happens, he seems to think that the other side would simply have the other's back for sure. If you go down, I'll get your back. If I go down, make sure you're there for me. But we're going to win this thing. And he makes this very short, but I think really kind of wonderful speech before battle. I have no idea how this was delivered. I don't have audio, unfortunately. I looked, I Googled it, but there was no audio of this. I didn't Google it. That was a lie. But the Bible lied, right? We already covered that. So I can say whatever I want. 700, 7,000, 1,700. But I imagine that it was a little bit more hushed than the typical Hollywood battle speech, right? I mean, maybe William Wallace was screaming and drooling. I have no idea. I wasn't there for that either. But based on the content of the message that he's speaking here, I feel like maybe Yoav just had this really calm swagger about him. He just wanted to remind his troops, hey, be of good courage. Let us be strong for our people and for the cities of God, you know, and may the Lord do what is good in his sight. You know, I can't imagine him like on horseback, like waving the flag. Like it just doesn't fit with this, because it's not that kind of message. It's just this really calm, assured, just we got God on our side, you know? And I, maybe that's my imagination, but the words seem to have that inclination to me. So the Aramens run away, and then the Ammonites run away after them, and then Yisrael wins, and that's how it works. I want to see like the battle, now we get, like, even with more recent histories that we know a little bit about, I can just watch the movie Gettysburg and kind of know how that battle went, outflank here and get the actual war strategies. We just know that they ran away because they had them surrounded, and then they ran away because now they don't have them surrounded. And, you know, the second one makes a lot more sense than the first one. But either way, it's interesting that Israel or Israel, wins this. They regroup. Talking about the Aramens, because they're nothing if not a persistent enemy, right? These guys, they don't give up. I mean, they might give up this battle because they ran away, but they're going to come back. They're going to regroup, and they're always going to come back. And so they do that. They regroup, and because of that, David gathers Yisrael, crosses the Jordan, or Yarden is actually how it's called, Yarden, and battle ensued. So before the Aramens flee once more, David kills thousands and thousands of men, including Commander Shofak. Don't mispronounce his name. Then the Ammonites made a peaceful surrender, with which Aram upset. Made Aram upset with Ammon. Y'all get that? So Aram is upset because Ammon makes a peaceful surrender. It doesn't make Aram happy that these people are being peaceful with Israel at this point. So, and this is where the chapter ends. Okay, and there's still unfinished business. In the next chapter, it'll pick up at Rabbah. And the offending Ammonites are in their city, and Yoav went back to Yerushalayim. Still the hardest one to say. And so chapter 20 is going to pick up there, but it's going to pick up in the spring, sending Yoav and the army out once more to deal with Rabbah as he waits in Yerushalayim. And so I think it's kind of cool that we're taking our break for the holidays. At the same time, the narrative has this sort of jump cut to, I'm serious, I think it's kind of cool. Like, no, I don't think anybody planned it that way. Rob's not that smart, so. But yeah, so we're going to pick it up in the spring, and we're going to pick it up after the new year. It's going to be kind of interesting on that. I do want to make one more note before we head into the break and, you know, before, you know, we eat our milk and cookies and such. It was in the absence of the battle that's going to break out in chapter 20. So over this, you know, these few months, I don't know exactly how long, but over these few months where things are calm, David's not in battle. He's, you know, doing other kingly duties or having other people feed him grapes. I don't know what he's doing, but he's not in battle. And then when the battle does start again, he abstains from going when he should have gone. He kind of stays behind. So over this time, he's kind of lounging around, kind of like we're likely to do, you know, on Wednesday nights for the next month or so. And it was over that time. Does anybody know what happened over that time? A big thing in David's life. Yeah, yeah. Bathsheba shows up on the scene. And it's when David is relaxed and stuffing his face full of Christmas ham, that he didn't celebrate Christmas, guys. That's a joke. Jesus wasn't even alive yet. You guys. But it's over that time when he's not, you know, full bore, like, I'm in battle, I got God on my side, like, you know, it's kind of a come down from that, and he's relaxed, that Bathsheba shows up, and for those who don't know, that's not a good thing for him. He, as the Bible eloquently words it, falls into sin. And so as we're doing this, as we're eating milk and cookies and celebrating the incarnate Christ and everybody signing up for gym memberships, you know, at the new year, let's not lose focus, right? Let's not let the absence of a Wednesday night or even just the absence, or the presence rather of all the festivities around us, take our eyesights off of God. Let's remain diligent, watchful, and let's follow David's good examples while also learning, from his failings. So that's all, we're going to talk about today, but I'll pray and, get us out of here. God, thank you so much for your words here. Thank you for giving us a biblical text that has slight imperfections. I think that there's something so honest about that and kind of refreshing even. So in a weird way, thank you for your mistakes. And then also just for the example that David does give us, we can have these people to look to, these stories to bring us together on Wednesday nights and share. That can really be guides to our lives, God, that we can actually look at other people and learn from them and look at other examples. So I ask that that'll happen, God, that tonight, maybe something will fester into our heads a little bit and we'll take something away from this, that you will have taught us something and that nestled down there, it'll become a truth that our lives can embody, as we continue to number our days. In Jesus' name, amen.